The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
So today we are definitely strapping in for a bit of a high contact history lesson. We're diving into Chris Herring's really essential book, Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 1990s New York Knicks. Wow, if you lived through that decade, you know this team. Well, they're more than just basketball.
That's exactly it. That's the core tension the book really gets into. The 1990s Knicks, they were this cultural phenomenon, right? They perfectly embody that gritty, like uncompromising spirit of New York City, doing what was a really transformative decade for the city.
Right.
And what Herring asks fundamentally is this: how does a team that, you know, never actually won a championship become so deeply embedded in our collective consciousness? It's like they achieved immortality through failure. Almost.
And that's what makes this deep dive so relevant today, I think. It goes far beyond just basketball history, you know? We're looking at a case study in organizational identity, relentless leadership, and really how culture can sometimes trump pure talent when it comes to leaving a lasting legacy.
Yeah.
And here's where it gets really interesting. This team became famous, essentially, for not winning the big one. It's fascinating. Okay, before we plunge into, like, the legendary brawls and all that intense stuff, we should probably talk about the author, Chris Herring.
Good idea.
He's a seriously seasoned sports writer. He's written for, well, pretty much every major publication you can think of, Wall Street Journal, 538, Sports Illustrated.
And his perspective is really key here, I think. Herring brings this rare combination. He's a gifted narrative storyteller, right? He can bring characters like Patrick Ewing and Charles Oakley vividly back to life. But he also has that analytical distance. He came from a more data-driven journalism background, like 538.
Huh.
And crucially, he wasn't emotionally tangled up in it as, say, a local beat writer covering them day in, day out during that era.
Huh. Does that objectivity help him, you think? Or does it maybe mean he misses some of that, like, visceral passion of the time?
Well, the book really suggests it helps, immensely, actually. It allowed him to cut through a lot of the myths that had built up over the years. He spent years on this project, conducted over 200 interviews.
Wow, 200.
Yeah, talking to virtually every key figure you could imagine. Players, coaches, executives, and, this is critical, their rivals.
Ah, the rivals too, obviously.
Exactly. And that level of research, that authority, it allowed him to uncover some incredibly nuanced and sometimes, frankly, unflattering details that really separate the legend from the, well, the often painful truth.
Okay, the painful truth. It seems like it starts with one man determined to just eradicate softness. Pat Riley. Herring chronicles this, like, radical shift that began when Riley arrived in 1991.
Oh.
He consciously dismantled the previous finesse culture they had. And he was absolutely determined, it sounds like, to build a team based on the exact opposite principles. Defense first, brutal physicality, and these non-negotiable standards of effort.
It wasn't just a coaching change.
Yeah.
Right? It was like a philosophical declaration.
Yeah.
A statement of intent. The book traces their rapid ascent. They became the league's most feared defensive unit, pretty much defined by those, well, warlike playoff battles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the constant pressure cooker against Michael Jordan's Bulls, obviously.
Yeah.
Then the emotional chaos against Reggie Miller's Pacers.
Oh, Reggie Miller, yeah.
And later, that intensely personal hostility against Riley's own Miami Heat team. Just layer upon layer of rivalry.
And the emotional core of this whole saga, the thing I think every Knicks fan remembers vividly, is the 1994 season. Mm-hmm. Jordan retired, right? The path was finally clear. It felt like the year.
Yes. The window.
Exactly. And the story hinges on that gut-wrenching seven-game finals loss. But what's also really compelling is how the story doesn't end there. It continues through Riley's shocking departure, the fax machine incident, and then the team's final kind of improbable run as an eighth seed in 1999 under Jeff Van Gundy.
And what's fascinating, getting back to Herring's thesis, is how their success and their failure were just completely intertwined. The very identity that made them so formidable, that relentless physicality, the brute force, it also kind of created a cage for them.
How so?
Well, that intensity often translated into predictable offensive sets. You knew what they were going to do. It led to costly flagrant fouls, suspensions at the worst times, and just a kind of rigidity that proved ultimately impossible to overcome in those high-stakes moments. They were almost victims of their own philosophy.
Okay, let's unpack how Riley actually built that philosophy. He started with what the book calls shock therapy. I mean, we're talking three-hour practices. A level of non-negotiable commitment that was pretty much unheard of at the time, and just a complete intolerance for anything less than maximum effort. It sounds less like training and more like psychological conditioning.
Totally. And Riley knew he needed specific leaders to execute this vision. The twin pillars were Patrick Ewing, you know, the Stoic superstar, burdened with the weight of delivering a title the city hadn't seen since 1973.
Right, the long wait.
And Charles Oakley, the undisputed enforcer. Oakley set the physical tone, full stop. If you were going to challenge the Knicks, you had to go through him physically. That was the price of admission to play against them.
It feels like their identity, that whole us against the world mentality, was really forged in that crucible of repeated loss, especially against the Bulls.
Yeah.
Herring frames those physical wars against Chicago not just as failures, but almost as like necessary steps to cement their resilience. They failed to win the ultimate prize against Jordan, sure, but they became absolutely convinced they could physically destroy anyone else.
Which brings us right back to 1994, the golden opportunity, and the subsequent agony. You have the legendary Eastern Conference Finals against Reggie Miller and the Pacers. And this wasn't just a standard rivalry. It was a total clash of cultures.
Oh.
You had the Knicks, blue-collar, grinded-out defense versus Miller's flamboyant, sharpshooting psychological warfare. He loved getting under their skin.
Miller was the perfect antagonist for that Knicks mentality, wasn't he? He seemed to thrive on the chaos they created.
Precisely. He fed off it. Herring details that whole volatile series, including, of course, Miller's iconic 25-point fourth quarter in Game 5 at the Garden.
The choke sign to Spike Lee, unforgettable.
Exactly. Think about that moment.
Yeah.
Miller gives the choke sign to Spike Lee courtside, and it felt like the roof of the Garden might just collapse from the panic and rage. But the Knicks survived that series. That moment of nearly drowning and then pulling through kind of defined the mental toughness they had developed.
But survival in the East only led to the ultimate heartbreak, didn't it? The pressure on Ewing in the finals against Houston was just immense. And the book gives this almost unbearable account of the end of the 94 finals. Everyone remembers John Starks.
Oh, game seven.
His devastating 2-for-18 shooting performance in game seven. You can practically feel the weight of an entire city crashing down in that one stat line.
The psychological toll Herring describes is just immense. The tragedy wasn't simply losing. It was that this was the year. The one clear path, the season without Jordan blocking the way.
Right.
And to be one shot away, maybe one Starks basket away from actually seizing it, it meant that failure became like eternal in the memory of the franchise and its fans. Just brutal.
And then from that agony, we somehow transition to the great betrayal. Pat Riley orchestrates his exit, the infamous fax, to become the coach and president of the Miami Heat.
Yep. Unbelievable.
Instantly creating one of the most personal, bitter, and hostile rivalries in sports history, like overnight.
And the irony is just incredible. Riley's own mild-mannered assistant, Jeff Van Gundy, was the one left holding the bag, the one who had to maintain that defensive intensity Riley had built.
Right, the unassuming guy.
Totally unassuming. Yet he was the one leading the team through those absolutely infamous playoff brawls against Riley's new Heat team. The book has that unforgettable visual. Van Gundy literally hanging on to Alonzo Mourning's leg during the huge 1997 brawl.
I remember seeing that. It was wild.
It's almost comedic, but it perfectly encapsulates the inherited grit of the system, right?
Yeah.
The coach is physically throwing himself into the fight, clinging on to the opposing star's leg. That's dedication.
That is a culture right there. Wow. And their final sort of defiant gasp came in the lockout-shortened 1999 season. They barely squeaked into the playoffs as an eighth seed.
Barely.
But shocked everyone. They upset the number one seed Heat again and rode these new athletic additions like Latrell Sprewell and Marcus Camby all the way to the finals.
It was pure resilience, just stunning. But the script kind of held firm in the end. An aging core, Ewing suffering a debilitating Achilles injury. It meant they ultimately fell short in the finals again. Another dream denied. The pattern was just set. Maximum effort, maximum drama, and ultimately heartbreaking failure on the biggest stage.
Okay, so we've tracked the pain, the passion, the rivalries, the culture. Let's maybe shift our focus now to the themes and like the real world applications that Herring pulls from this whole decade long saga.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's start with that central theme we kind of identified earlier. Identity is a double-edged sword. The lesson here for really any organization is profound. the strength of the Knicks, their physicality, their defense, it eventually became this rigid framework, almost a cage.
Okay.
They couldn't pivot. They couldn't adapt when strategy demanded maybe more finesse or different offensive looks, like in the 94 finals against Hakeem Olajuwon and the Rockets' skilled offense. They just kept trying to hammer away.
So the application for, you know, you listening is pretty clear. Critical self-assessment is necessary. You have to make sure your core strengths, the things you absolutely rely on, don't actually prevent necessary evolution when the environment around you changes.
Exactly.
Like, if you manage a team, how do you reward that tenacity without letting it breed rigidity? It's a tough balance.
It really is. And another critical theme is New York City as a character in this whole drama. The Knicks' aggressive blue-collar style was just a perfect mirror image of 1990s New York City, tough, raw, unapologetic.
Absolutely.
The city didn't just support them, the city was them, in a way. And this underscores the importance, I think, of understanding and maybe leveraging your local context and community values in whatever you're trying to build. Authenticity really matters. People connect with it.
And that leads right into the final, maybe the most profound lesson, legacy beyond championships. Herring makes a really convincing case that the team's lasting impact actually comes from the emotional connection they forged, the sheer effort, the attitude they displayed, not the banners they ultimately lacked.
Yeah, and this completely changes how you might view success. It encourages us to reflect on maybe creating enduring meaning and impact rather than just chasing conventional short-term metrics like only counting the wins.
Right.
The process itself, the commitment to the fight, the shared struggle that's often what people remember and connect with long after the specific outcome is forgotten.
Yeah, definitely. And the book is just packed with memorable lines, quotes that perfectly capture this team's philosophy and the whole atmosphere they cultivated.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Riley's philosophical cornerstone, the thing that really explains why the team resonated so much culturally, was simple. Defense travels better than offense. What he meant was that effort, consistency, defensive principles, those are reliable things you can bring anywhere, unlike, say, individual scoring talent or shooting accuracy, which can fluctuate. It represented reliable, almost moral values.
That makes sense. And the atmosphere they created in Madison Square Garden, I mean, it was legendary. It was captured when one player apparently said, MSG wasn't just our home court, it was our fortress. You just feel the hostility they cultivated, how they leveraged their environment. The crowd, the building itself became weapons, integral parts of their competitive identity.
For sure. And their entire attitude towards opponents, towards the media, everything was pretty much summed up by this line. We weren't trying to be liked. We were trying to be respected.
Ooh, I like that.
Right. And that philosophy shaped everything they did. They prioritized intensity, accountability, grit over trying to be popular or getting good press. They were genuinely tough, and they really didn't care if you enjoyed watching them play. Respect was the currency.
So if we think about the real-life applications of all this, Riley's systematic culture overhaul, it's almost like a masterclass in management, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Build a strong, clear, and consistently enforced identity. If your standards are truly non-negotiable, it seems like you align diverse, high-performing individuals much more easily around a common goal.
And the resilience factor here is just huge. The Knicks' ability to stay competitive year after year, despite these repeated, absolute soul-crushing failures, losing to Jordan again and again in Starks Game 7, it teaches the immense value of focusing on the process over just the outcome. You know, when you lose, you don't automatically become a failure. You just regroup and continue the process.
Yeah.
Failure isn't necessarily the final destination.
And Patrick Ewing's journey, wow, it's kind of the ultimate high-pressure case study. The takeaway for anyone facing just immense expectations is maybe to focus only on the controllable factors, you know? Maximize your strengths rather than constantly trying to compensate for every perceived weakness or just succumbing to that external pressure to win the one big prize.
Yeah, well said. And if we really connect this to the bigger picture, I think the most profound lesson Herring delivers is that success, real success, cannot be measured solely by, like, gold medals or trophies. The authentic commitment to a set of fierce principles, to an identity, often creates an impact that is far more profound and endures much longer than any championship ring itself might.
So what does this all mean then? Wrapping up, what really stands out to me is how the team's glorious, incredibly dramatic failure somehow immortalized them. It's paradoxical.
It really is.
They created this kind of template for how organizations, maybe even communities, can build lasting legacies through shared struggle and that relentless commitment to common, maybe blue-collar values. They were a team that became much greater than their final win-loss record, and that is a truly rare and maybe even more valuable achievement in the long run. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.